Blog Talk Radio.
All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to your Unbooked show. And we've got Jonathan Honing on the show today. And I told him to dress up for the show. So he's dressed up. Now, I don't have... Hey, Jonathan, let me... I'm sorry. YouTube is giving me a hard time for some reason. There's always something, right? There's always something. Why today? Why? All right, come on. So it's on Facebook. We got it on Facebook. I guess I can load it up on YouTube. But then we don't have Super Chat.
Oh, yeah. No, we gotta get those 5s and 10s stuffed into our proverbial G-string. So let's get that working.
We gotta.
I want to do like a tote board thing. Let's check the tote board.
Oh, all right. I don't know. What's the tote board thing?
The tote board was like a telethon, you know, they'd say.
Oh, yeah, with the money going up, yeah.
Jerry Lewis would check
the tote
board.
We got to get those 5s and 10s stuffed in our proverbial G-string, so let's make that good.
Let's turn off myself.
So is that you on Facebook?
Yeah, but I'm going to turn myself off. I'm going to be focused on you, your own.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. All right.
What? Maybe Facebook is already, or maybe YouTube is already now deplatforming you and out to get you. Now. Maybe this is already they're after
this
you.
Is this is it. This is me being deplatformed by YouTube. No, there it is. We got you on.
After you, this is it.
Right. There is Jonathan. All right. You know, we're muting that. Welcome to live chat, pop-up chat. All right.
Is everyone now frantically buying the book? Is that what?
I think so. I think that's the sound you're hearing from Amazon is people frantically buying the book.
Good.
I don't
$19.
Almost nobody's on YouTube yet, so I don't know why that is, but hopefully they'll find it. I think the stream is... All right, let's start over. Blank slate, wrap yourself up properly, get yourself all arranged. All right. Because I'm gonna slice it and dice it and start from, no, put the book up, from now. All right, everybody, welcome to the Ron Brooks Show. We've got Jonathan Honing on today. This is going to be a lot of fun. I asked Jonathan to dress up for a discussion of Americanism. And because, you know, he always appears on Fox in costume, and he should appear in costume on the Ron Brooks Show as well. So... We've already got somebody commenting on how insane people are in Chicago on YouTube. So you might want to put up the YouTube chat. That's where we get the alt-right and the trolls.
I know. And wouldn't be your own Brooks show without a heavy dose of anti-Semites on YouTube.
That's right. So, Jonathan, thank you for doing the show. Thanks for being on.
My great pleasure. Good to be with your own and happy to talk about and happy to be enthusiastic about a topic that I am very passionate about. And you know what most people are very passionate about, and that is America in particular. That's part of what I think makes a new textbook of Americanism your own so exciting is that no matter where you are on the political spectrum, if you ask anyone, what do you think about America? They don't hesitate to turn around and tell you exactly what they think, where we are, where we should be going. This is a topic that really incites a lot of passion and me in particular.
No, absolutely. I think that the one thing that Americans across the political spectrum is patriotic, sometimes for the wrong reasons, but they're always patriotic. So it's a great conversation starter to talk about what is America, what America represents, what America should be like, what America is all about. So it's a great title. Of course, it's a title that you didn't really pick because it's Ayn Rand's title, but that makes it even better. It's an Ayn Rand title. And we're going to get to this. I want to do a few things that I always do with my guests. And feel free to unwind the costume as the interview goes on or whatever. Although it's very colorful, so it suits you. I want to start with getting to know you a little bit. And I don't even know that Jonathan and I have known each other, I don't know, for at least 10 years, right? At least since the financial crisis. Was it before that?
It was well before that, Your Honor. I mean, I first started getting interested in objectivism in the late 1990s, just around the time you first came to the Ayn Rand Institute. And so much of, I'll just say off the top, I mean, so much of my own education in objectivism and my ability to learn about objectivism over the year, I'll say it really has come thanks to what you did in terms of building a movement around the Institute beginning. I think you started in 2000, as I remember.
Started January 2000, yes.
Yeah, so so it's been almost 20 years. How can that be if I'm only 29 years old?
I know, that's ridiculous. It'll be 19 years. Yeah, I mean, this January is 19 years. So that's pretty insane. And all right. So yeah. So you came. How did you discover Ayn Rand?
Well, I had always been fascinated with, like, Mr. Rogers here. You know, I got to take the sweater off.
There you go. Now,
take this
shoes
off. I had always been fascinated with trade, and I've told this story a bit before you're on. I told it at Ocon. I've always been actually fascinated with trade. Trade has been always just a true passion of mine.
Did you put something over your mic? It just feels like you're. Did you put something over the mic? It feels like you're. The sound.
No, I'll come a little closer.
I'll come a little closer. There you go.
So I'd always been absolutely fascinated by trade, even from an early age. So that had always been a real passion for me, and I had always seen Yaron again, even as from a very young person, I understood trade was justice. I really understood that this was something that was, I don't think I could have enunciated that as a nine-year-old, but I got that. And when it came to trade, you know, when you're on the playground, it's like there's bullies and then there's trade.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And I knew, you know, the bully, that was unjust. And the trade, that was how life was supposed to be.
Did you trade like cards or marbles or anything like that?
Yeah, it was
fun. I did.
Yeah. I'm not one of those, I would never be so bold as to say that Ayn Rand said a lot of or brought to me a lot of what I had already seen. You know, I had it all figured out. Obviously not it at all. But, you know, I discovered her, Yaron, finally was in college. And I was a student at Northwestern University. I'll make the long story short because, you know, let's get to the meat.
Oh, it's good. It's good. Yeah.
Well, I was interested in ideas. And I was studying philosophy.
Okay.
And Plato and, Kant and Heidegger and Habermas. They had a guy named Jürgen Habermas come, Yaron. You know
what
this is?
That is? No, I don't.
he's apparently, I mean, I took 3.5 years of philosophy at Northwestern, and I ended up hating the world even more confused about the world. I didn't know what to make of it. The more I studied philosophy, the more kind of dark and bleak I became. And to make the long story somewhat short, it was around that time I finally discovered Ayn Rand. And I really got into her.
By chance? By chance?
Well, it was always the thing that people had said to me, you should read Ayn Rand.
Yeah, yeah.
And I took a look at this book, and I said, oh boy.
That's a big read.
That's a big read. And in fact, that's part of what I think, I'll quickly say, your own makes textbook so great, is that, you know, this is 180 pages.
Yeah, it's short. It's great.
Introduction to Individualism. We'll get to it. So I discovered Ayn Rand, to make, again, the long story short, in college. And it wiped away everything I was studying at Northwestern. And I became a student of objectivism, which I am to this day. And, you know, I'll sum it up in saying that it's just made my life so incalculably better.
Yep.
It made my business life better, made me a happier person,
yep.
Made my friendships better, made my love life better. So, you know, I'm just so glad I discovered Ayn Rand, and the ability now to build a little bit on her work with textbook has been, like, it's so cliche, but a real long time passion of mine come true.
That's great. And when did you start the hedge fund? And then when did you become the media celebrity that you are today? When did you kind of build that relationship with Fox? And I know you do a lot of radio in Chicago and elsewhere. How did that happen? And when did it happen?
Sure. Well, in the 90s, actually around the same time I was discovering Ayn Rand, I was at Northwestern University, and I wanted to trade. I mean, trading had always been my passion, and I dropped out of school. I left school to trade at the Chicago Board of Trade. on the floor. This is back in the days when they still did the screaming and yelling. And around that time, this is, I think, 1998, I wanted to trade other people's money. I wanted to launch a product that would allow me to, and your own, even back then, because, you know, even back then, you know, to open a mutual fund, a highly regulated business.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you needed back then $20 million basically just to break even. And this was 20 years ago. That's like $40 million today. So I was able to start my own investment partnership with $150,000 of friends and family money. I've grown it since then, and be able to start a business, which thankfully continues to this day. So, you know, I've been so fortunate, Yaron, to just be involved with, and I've heard you say this so frequently that you could have done a lot of things with your life that would have been more lucrative.
Yep.
You know, gone to Wall Street or, you know, this and that, the quantitative. But, you know, and I feel very much that you've done what you want. And I feel so very much the same way for me. It's like I'm able to be involved with markets, involved with ideas and philosophy. And I love what I do. So
that's
I'm
great.
Blessed.
And how did the Fox relationship come about, or the kind of the media? Was that around Capitalist Pig originally, right?
Yes. So in college, I actually started a radio show.
Oh, wow.
Well, for young people. I mean, the idea was is that I was very interested in money and in the market. I mean, back in the 90s especially,
the
market was
the .com, the whole .com thing. It was a fun time.
Yeah, and it was a good. You know, I learned a lot of lessons back then.
As did I.
Sure.
Anybody in the markets learned lessons back then. Yeah.
So the radio show was pretty unique because at the time the thought was, oh, you know, young people aren't interested in finance, they're not interested in money. That I think has proved to be not the case, and subsequently very much so not the case. So I got some exposure and some coverage as a result of that, and I started making appearances on National Public Radio on Marketplace publications here and there on CNN and MTV, et cetera. And around that time, actually, Fox News Channel was just starting, if you can believe it. It was hadn't even started then. In fact, the people I was writing for Jim Cramer's, I'm reading some of his comments Jim Cramer's site, thestreet.com. Those people left. They started the Fox business program.
Yep.
They needed somebody to talk. Obviously, I have no problem with that.
Nope.
And to my benefit, Yaron, very briefly, you know, a lot of the people from Morgan Stanley and Merrill Lynch, et cetera, they wouldn't let them say anything. So, you know, most Morgan Stanley people couldn't say, I like this stock, I don't like this stock.
Yep.
So I think they appreciated an independent trader's perspective. And that's when I kind of my media career began.
Cool. So what shows are you on these days? Just so people who want to follow
sure,
you.
I'm on primarily on Fox Business.
Yep.
And I'm on with Kennedy. I'm on with Stuart Varney. I'm on with Neil Gavuda. I'd like to think of myself, Neil, not unlike you, that, you know, when they shine that dollar sign like Batman, you know, when Batman gets the bat signal, he'll go.
Yeah.
I mean,
you're
the king of this. You are, you know, we all bow down, but
nobody invites me anymore. You know, the Fox in particular has given up on me for whatever reason, but they have. Yeah.
Well, you know, I was on the Fox News Channel every year for 14 years up until the point that I said I didn't think that Donald Trump should be president. I was never on again. It's another discussion altogether.
All right.
But
connected.
You know, I go on whenever they want to talk about capitalism, business, spending, business markets. I'm happy to show up, I know as you do as well.
No, that's great. That's great. All right, Liberal Deutsch, who's been asking a ton of questions the last few days, is gonna. We'll get to that. We'll get to his question.
You know, globalism is talked about actually quite extensively in the book.
Yeah, so let's jump into this question. What the hell? Do you understand the negative association people can have with globalism as practice, just in the form of reality TV hipsters and McDonald's? So again, I've talked about globalism in the past. I mean, I think globalism is a package deal, the way it's being used today. It's a package deal of free trade, of globalization in a sense of free trade and free movement of capital and free movement of goods. and of what Jonathan's looking for, which is a section in the book where Ayn Rand herself discusses the idea of one world government. So it's this, it's a package deal of those two ideas. Now, you bring up the, Liberal Deutsch brings up the idea of globalism as also this cultural phenomena of American culture, i.e. McDonald's, reality TV, hipsters, being exported to the rest of the world and affecting the rest of the world, which is all true. The question is, why is that bad? And I mean, I've said, I'm not for one world government. What did Ayn Rand say about one world government, John?
Well, she answers that explicitly, Your Honor. And actually, that's one of the things I think is so exciting about the book, about a new textbook of Americanism, is that thanks to the Ayn Rand Institute and the Ayn Rand archives, included in the book is never before published conversations with Ayn Rand.
Yep.
I mean, we really have to emphasize these are her off-the-cuff, unscripted comments on a bunch of topics specifically related to politics and epistemology. And one of the things she is asked, as you're alluding to, is that, you know, why not have a world government? You know, should we have a world government? I don't want to spoil it. I don't want to give away too much, but she makes a wonderful allusion to Frank Lloyd Wright and getting marriage, and Frank Lloyd Wright and marriage, setting the perspective that people who really need to get marriage is for people who don't need to get married.
Yeah.
I'll leave it at that and just and tease you with that. She addresses that very specifically.
Yeah, no, it's a great part of the book is the whole section where Ayn Rand is talking about, a number of different questions that relate to political philosophy or the application of political philosophy. And it's all never been published before. So this is the first publication. So it's really, really exciting. But yeah, I mean, Ayn Rand basically says in the book, as I've said many times, and one world government is illegitimate, but nobody who believes in globalization and free trade and free movement really believes in one world government. It's a package deal that they try to use in order to really ridicule the idea of free trade and free movement of capital.
I'll put this, if I can say, around, you know, that. Stuart Hayashi,
yep,
was my co-publisher on that. And he, you know, one of the questions Ayn Rand asked, I'll quickly just say, so Ayn Rand in 1946 outlined 44 questions that were going to be her textbook of Americanism, her everyman's guide to the basic principles on which the country was founded. Now, she answered 11 of them. She never answered the remaining. That's what the book is. It's the, again, no one speaks for Ayn Rand, but it's some of the scholars who know her work the best, finishing, if you will, some of her unanswered questions. Stuart Hayashi was asked, or he was charged with answering the question, which Ayn Rand posed, how do you recognize a Nazi? Now, in 1946, this was a real issue. You know, this was just in the aftermath of the war, and Nazis were still around. The Nazi philosophy was still very much around. So Stuart relates it to the current phenomena of the alt-right, and they're the ones, Yaron, who really perpetrate this globalist. And Stuart refers to it as an epithet, as a slur.
Yep.
And I think it's exactly as you said, it's a package deal meant to put things together which really don't belong to be together.
Yeah, because I am a globalist in the sense that I believe in free movement of goods, of capital, of people, and of ideas, and of entertainment. So the fact that somebody in Mumbai can sit down and watch a reality TV show that was produced in America is pretty cool, right? Or watch Fox Business with Jonathan Oning on in the Sahara Desert. I mean, that is amazingly cool that all of that exists. And I think Ayn Rand definitely, you can see that in her textbook. Her focus is not on where is the border, who are the people who look like me. It is a universal philosophy. It's a philosophy that's even early on, as early as this book was written, her contribution to the book, at least the early chapters, right? The later chapters actually late. She's writing those in the 60s, right? The seminars,
yes,
on non-political philosophy. So you know what? Let's back off because we're getting caught up in the questions. And of course, the super chat is flowing here. The money is just rolling in.
I got to cut that, right? You're on what
absolutely
percentage?
Absolutely. 220?
Is that how it works?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a. Let's talk about the book because that's what we're really here to do. And we'll get to all your questions later. So hold on if you've got questions that are unrelated. But I want to get to how you decided on the project. Because I remember, you know, it's been years when you first approached me about the project and we got the rights to everything and it took a while. So why you took this on, what motivated you to do it, and why it took so long. It took a long time, Jonathan. What's up?
Like a lot of people, you know, your own, I first started reading Ayn Rand, and I, as a young person especially, I devoured it and consumed it greedily and enjoyed all of it. And now as an adult, I've gone back and reread a lot of things. One of the things I read of hers was that early pamphlet, which you alluded to. Hers was simply Textbook of Americanism.
Yes.
It was published originally by an association known as the Motion Picture Association for the Preservation of American Ideals. This is a group of really the top Hollywood stars of the day. Ronald Reagan, Walt Disney were among the big luminaries part of it. And so her 11 questions were serialized in the publication. Then the publication was abandoned. So her original textbook, Yaron, it was always out there, but never really well known.
Yep.
People kind of who followed Ayn Rand maybe had seen the pamphlet. I believe it appeared in Peter Schwartz's book, The Ayn Rand Column, which was published, I believe, in the 1990s. But when I first read Ayn Rand's original textbook of Americanism, and of course it's included in the new book, it blew me away, Yaron. I mean, Ayn Rand's writing is tremendous.
Yep.
It's her efficiency of words. She doesn't waste a word. In the fewest amount of words possible, she just presented so eloquently the basic principles of the country that any person your own, and this really is for a college audience, for someone in their 20s or their early 30s, this is very easy reading. It's not dense philosophical text. So again, to make a long story short, I read it in the 90s, blew me away in terms of connecting me with really what I loved about the country. And that is its individualism. I mean, Ayn Rand's basic principle. And, you know, she starts the book not with, America is about gun rights or it's about borders.
Yep.
She says, what is the basic principle? The basic principle. That's so awesome about Ayn Rand. She starts with the very basics, not with, well, do I have a right to this or that? But it's a basic issue in the world today. It's between individualism and collectivism. America is the individualist country. That is what we are. It is our DNA. And that is on which she builds her whole framework and on which the country is built, and unfortunately, which so many people are completely lost today.
No, it's exactly right. And it's this idea that there's a principle behind it all, right? That there is a principle to guide one's life and a principle to guide a country. And for her, individualism is that principle. And what makes America unique about all countries and all of history is it was a country founded on this principle, right? I mean, the founding fathers knew what they were doing. This is not an accidental country. It's a country of ideas.
Yeah. I mean, it's so powerful. You have been a big, and you're of course featured in the book, and you've been a huge supporter of the book from the get-go. Yep. But your emphasis and all your speaking and writing over the years, even just a few weeks ago, I remember you were discussing the Khashoggi murders, and you were talking about Saudi Arabia, and just you're aghast that this is a kingdom.
Yeah.
Like, what kind of a backward society that has a kingdom and princes and rulers, and it's so foreign to us.
And we should take them seriously, and we should bow before them, and we should dance with them, and we should pretend that they're equal to us, not equal maybe financially, but equally morally. That's what's so offensive, is the expectation that they are the same as us. Yeah, they're kingdoms in the world, but you think it's like, they're African tribes over there, primitive tribes, and they're kingdoms over there. Yeah, they still haven't gotten what their founders got in the 18th century. They're 200 years behind. But to take Saudi Arabia seriously, that's what's so offensive.
Yeah, and especially now, and that's what I think makes the project. You asked what's taken it so long. Well, it's taken a while, and anyone who says that objectivists don't collaborate and don't work together, I mean, this has been a true collaboration with many, many terrific objectivists, the Institute, obviously, Jeff Bruning, Shoshana Milgram, Stuart Hayashi, who I mentioned, Jennifer Woodson at the Institute, all these terrific authors. It's taken a while, but I think it comes at a really important time, Yaron, because this notion of what America is almost completely up for grabs.
Yep.
You know, people just feel, well, I, you know, what do you think America's at? It's about you are your brother's keeper. It's about country first. It's about love your neighbor. It's up for grabs. But Ayn Rand is the American philosopher.
Yeah, I want to get to that. So I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the timing couldn't be better. And I think it's not just that people are asking questions and there are lots of different answers to it. It's that over the last few years, and I really think this is kind of as a large phenomenon, I think it's new. Over the last few years, a wrong interpretation has been presented in terms of what is America, and an interpretation that maybe goes exactly the opposite of what Ayn Rand would have given, and that is a collectivistic interpretation of America. I mean, are you seeing that? Are you seeing kind of the people who say America first, the people who are advocating for Americanism, and, you know, are the people who are now the collectivists, the doing it in the name of the state. And that to me is very scary, and why this is so needed, because it's needed to return us to a proper interpretation of what Americanism is.
Yeah, I always feel that the rugged individualism, you know, which is talked about explicitly in the book, C. Bradley Thompson has a wonderful essay, and I love your own. He makes the point that, you know, you can move to anywhere else in the world. You could move to Germany and live there for 20 years. They would never consider you German. You know, people move to America, and no one says, let me see your papers. Are you really American? It's like, if you work at the coffee shop and you trade and you're living here, you're American. You're one of us. You have our ideas.
Well, that's what's starting to change, right?
Right. So I think that's what's unique now is that, you know, even there is no even lip service now given your own to rugged individualism anymore.
Yep.
And I think a lot of individualism that we used to see as America's great benefit is almost seen as a hindrance now by a lot of individuals. It's like, oh, yeah, free speech, but come on, it's getting in the way of what we need to do. Oh, come on, free trade, it's really getting in the way of what we need to do. And, you know, America is not about we. America is about me. It's about I. Now, this is me talking. This is not Ayn Rand. But I believe, you know, and that's why I'm so proud of the cover, is that, you know, this is the country that says it's not sacrifice. It's not, oh, you're born with this debt and serve the king and bow down. It's just from the moment you're born, you can make your life of what you want. And my God, look at all the examples right in front of ours, people who came from nothing and they built fortunes. They built huge lives for themselves. And that only happens here. And that's what's so special about this country.
They come from all over the world and they can achieve anything here, and they can be themselves. And there's no, as long as they live up to the ideal of, you know, being responsible for themselves and taking care of themselves and honesty and integrity and living up to those American ideals, those individualistic ideals of, you know, the pursuit of happiness through virtue, then, you know, they are Americans. And this is not a country where, you know, again, with the exception of slavery and other abominations, you traditionally have been, no matter where you came from, no matter what your background is, no matter what your family name is, you could succeed in this country. You could achieve anything in this country. And it saddens me. I mean, people say, why do you yell so much? You're wrong. I mean, I yell because I care, right? And it pisses me off. It pisses me off when I see people doing things in the name of Americanism, in the name of America, and in the name of America first, which is going exactly the opposite direction of what America represents, what Americanism is, what America first should be, what a true American first ideal should be. So,
and that's what's so great about the book, Yaron, is that, you know, it's questioned. So it's very easily accessible. You can look up, you know, she asked, is there a difference between communism and fascism? We hear that a lot these days. Or how are fortunes made in a capitalist system? Or, you know, here's one that she asked, can we have planning and freedom at the same time?
Yeah, it's a question we get all the time, right? When you do public speaking, Why can't we have a little bit of planning? Just where it's appropriate, right? And she answers it brilliantly.
Yeah, it's just for the Volt. We just want the Chevy Volt. Let's just have the Volt, or let's just have Solyndra, or let's just have a couple billion for the farmers. We just need a little bit of central planning. And Ayn Rand is, I mean, genius, obviously, is kind of where you start.
Yeah.
She saw this all in the 40s. Yeah. And she laid this all out in the 1940s.
Yeah. And that's amazing. It's so relevant to today. Everything in the book is so absolutely relevant to what's going on today. So Adam is asking why the e-version of the book is in PDF and not in a format he can read on his smartphone or in his tablet.
I don't have an answer to that, but I will, if Adam DMs me on social media, I will find out and get back there.
There is another format for e-books. I can't remember what it's called, but it allows you to then read it on a Kindle and then everything else.
Oh, no, it is. Why is the e-version in PDF? No, it is. It is on Kindle. Gail's reminding me. Thank you, Gail. It is on Amazon. It's also an Audible narrated by.
Yes, so Adam, you can download it on Amazon. You can download it onto the iPad. I think I have a copy on my iPad in addition to the copies you have sent me. Thank you. I think I bought a Kindle one because I like to have it on my iPad because it's a reference. That's where my reference stuff is. So I'm not sure what you're referring to, Adam. It should be there. All right, let's go through these. See if there's anything relevant here. Ori says this question is not relevant, so I'm going to leave it to last. All right, so this is a quick one. Does a part of you believe that enlightenment is too powerful to be destroyed, that life will keep getting better and better until we reach objectivism? Do you want to answer that?
I think
is there a part of you that believes that? It doesn't have to be all of you. It doesn't have to be all the time, but because it's speculation about the future, which is hard. But is there part of you that believes that the enlightenment is so powerful that it won't be destroyed and things will just keep getting better?
I think your own truly, this is not blowing smoke. I think the groundwork that you and the Institute laid in the 90s and the 2000s, the books, all the speeches on a global scale is going to come home to roost, if you will, in the subsequent decades. And I think objectivism's heyday is still to come.
I think the power
of these ideas, and I don't think we need to have an ice age or a dark age in order for that to happen. So I'm very optimistic about the future. I'm concerned. Obviously, it's part of the reason I wrote the book, but I'm tremendously optimistic about the people are reading about Ayn Rand now all over the world. They're just now discovering these ideas. So I think. That's tremendously powerful, and I'm an optimist.
Yeah, I generally agree with Jonathan. There are days where I think only downhill, and we're doomed for dark ages, and the Donald Trumps of the world, and the alt-right, and the crazies are going to win out, and it's going to be a long haul. And then, but that passes usually pretty quickly. I think that, you know, the leftists are going to just dominate and take everything. But I do think overall that the Enlightenment is unbelievably powerful. And I think if the Enlightenment alone wouldn't be successful, the Enlightenment plus Ayn Rand is unbelievably powerful. And again, I don't think Ayn Rand, as Jonathan just articulated, I don't think it's just Ayn Rand has to turn everybody into an objectivist. I think we already have lots of evidence that Ayn Rand inspires people to be more productive, inspires people to start businesses, inspires people to be entrepreneurs, inspires people to be great business leaders. So I do think that there's a good chance that life will keep getting better and better until we reach objectivism. Not fast enough for me, but I do think we'll keep getting better. And there is a chance that that happens. I don't know how much probability to put on it, but I don't think that a dark ages is necessary. I try to convince Leonard Peacock once in a while about that, but he's not buying it. He's convinced the dark ages of the dark ages unnecessary. But I think we could see a progression of her influence and the Enlightenment broader influence, and not just in the U.S. One of the beauties is that I meant selling everywhere, and Enlightenment values are now a global phenomena. There's another way in which I am a globalist.
Yeah, and I'll be a bit of an egoist, Yaron, to think that I think what will save the country is the ideas that are in this book.
No question.
Save, it, you know, is Ayn Rand's understanding of individualism and individual rights. You know, I make the point, Yaron, you speak all over the world very successfully, but I always make the point, you know, what makes America so successful isn't like that the water here is so different than the water in Pyongyang or Cuba, or it's the idea.
Yep.
So any place in the world you've practiced individualism, capitalism, protected individual rights, those sprouts of prosperity grow and they always will.
Yep, absolutely. And it's a global ideology. There we go again with that globalism. All right. Yeah, so in that context, a few things you guys can do. First, you should buy the book for yourself. You should all buy it because you're all egoists. You should all buy the book so you can read it and enjoy it and learn from it. And I think anytime you've got an opportunity to read new Ayn Rand stuff, material, you got to jump on it. So for $9.99 or whatever the really, really low price that is, the book is going for, go get a copy. But the thing you should really be doing right now, given that this is the Christmas season and the season of gift giving, is you should buy like 20 of these. And these should be your stocking stuffers, right? Is that right? You know, do you like Christmas?
For sure.
Yeah.
I love Christmas.
Somebody asked, not on
the more commercial, the better.
Yeah, absolutely. I love Christmas. I love the lights. I love the stores. I love the gift giving. I love the buying. So buy. This is the book. Let's see if I can put it in the frame. There it is. It fits. Buy the book. Buy lots of them. Give them away as gifts to your family members. This is a great introduction. People always say, what's a good introduction to Ayn Rand's ideas? This is a great introduction to political philosophy. Everybody's talking about politics these days. Everybody's enamored with either loving Trump or hating Trump. And over Christmas dinner, and you're going to be debating Trump one way or the other. So get armed. Get all your relatives one of these. They'll hate you, but that's good. Maybe ultimately they'll love you once they read it. And that's how we'll change the world, by getting these books into the hands of as many of the right kind of people.
And your own, when you say right, I know you don't mean on the right, because...
No, we're not on the right.
And Ayn Rand is obviously not on the right.
So tell us, Jonathan, because a lot of people tell me this, but Ayn Rand identified herself as being on the right. So why do we say, I don't know why I say, but why do you say she's not on the right?
Well, I mean... you know, at the time she made those comments, Yaron, and please step in to correct me, yeah. We're talking about decades ago when the political lines in the country as they were drawn and understood were a lot different than they are now. And this scourge of collectivism, as I believe, has just grown now to infect all parties. I mean, at least in the Barry Goldwater, who Ayn Rand did support, espoused some elements of individualism. He put forth some elements of individualism, and there's none of that in today's political discourse at all. So, you know, you've said this before, I totally agree, is that, you know, Americanism is not on the current spectrum of left to right. It's almost off on the side. It's its own individualist entity, because left and right now are just two elements of collectivism. You know, the left, wants to tell you everything you have to do and buy, and wants you, you are your brother's keeper, and the right says it's country first. So it's sacrifice either way, sacrifice for your neighbor, sacrifice for the country. But the whole thing with America is that you don't have to sacrifice.
Yep. Well, you shouldn't sacrifice. You should actually,
You're not supposed to sacrifice. That's what makes this country so powerful. You own your life. You can make of it what you will. You don't have to serve the greater good. And that's what's been forgotten on today's political discourse, why the book is so important.
So Michael's asking what your thoughts are of the Free State Project.
I don't know.
So this is the project that says everybody who's for free market should move to New Hampshire, and because New Hampshire's small and it's got this free spirit and everything, and then vote in free market candidates, and then turn it into a model of freedom, which ultimately will resonate with the rest of the country and convert the rest of the country to capitalism.
Well, you're on every, I've listened to you for 20 years. People are always pitching you these quick workarounds.
Yeah.
And they always say, how is a shortcut to try to change people's ideas? But the only way to do it is, I believe, through education, which is what the Institute has always stressed. starting with people when they're young, because that's when they form these ideas. That's what makes it such a great thing for people in their 19 and 20 and 21 and 25 years old, is that by the time they're 30 and 35, you know, we get the politicians we deserve, as you always point out. So, you know, voting everyone in the state, I don't think is going to make any substantial changes. I don't think there's any shortcuts to try to change the world. It starts with education and young people in particular.
I think that's right. And if you're going to pick some way to do a project like that, it should be Puerto Rico, because you don't pay federal taxes, and you're not, you know, and you don't have to vote for president, which is a huge advantage. And you can declare independence one day and get out and really establish America in a new country. But no, I think Jonathan's right. You know, there's no lack of examples of the success of freedom. It's not like people don't know that capitalism works and that's why they don't adopt it. The reason people don't adopt capitalism is because of altruism. It's because of philosophy. It's because of morality. It's because of the rejection of individualism, which Ayn Rand identifies in this book as the key issue. And they don't identify individualism as moral, as good, as the basis on which to live. And therefore, they reject capitalism. So it's not that we miss a model. It's that we lack ideas. It's all about education, education, education. All right. That is also a question. Let me ask you. So you wrote a chapter in the book.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit why you chose that to write, and it, what it's about, what the chapter is, and why you chose that as the chapter.
Sure. Well, I answered two of Rand's questions, or tried to answer two of Rand's questions. One of which is, I think, I'll speak up briefly, is pretty relative today. And when she asks very simply, you know, would it pay us to divide great fortune?
Yep.
And would it pay us to take people who are wealthy and, you know, Bezos comes to mind as, you know, an example. And, you know, they've got a lot. They've been successful, yep. But there's millions of other people who don't have all they. So would it benefit us all if, you know, if we would divide up great fortunes and redistribute to those very much in need? And, you know, needless to say, the estate tax your own, I believe, is thoroughly un-American, and this idea that wealth is public wealth, and that if it benefits the greater good, well, we can take from Bezos and give to anyone else. And, you know, and Andy Bernstein and some of the other scholars in the book make the point as well that, you know, money in a capital in America is earned. You know, it's not stolen, it's not filched, it's not pilfered, it's earned.
Yep.
And people have a right. So I start the piece with a very simple question. You know, if you give someone your wristwatch, you know, it's theirs. The moment you give it to them, it's theirs. And government has no right to come in and take it and say, well, you know, the public really needs that wristwatch, other people who deserve it. So these are basic questions Rand was thinking about, you know, 70 years ago,
and
that are we're still now debating.
Yeah, and the way the question is framed already positions it as what she identifies as the core question, right? Us, who is us?
Mm-hmm.
Who is going to benefit? Who are the we that are going to benefit? And that's a collectivistic view. Even asking that question is framing the whole issue in terms of collectivism, in terms of what's good for the group. And her whole approach is, no, who owned the watch? Whose watch is it? You know, who gets to decide what happens to the wealth an individual produces? The individual. That's the individualist approach to asking questions about inheritance, for example, about you know, wealth redistribution. Whereas the question gives away the collectivism right off the bat.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, and now, you know, as you said, 70 years later, we're still debating. You know, well, did you really build that? And boy, someone else built the roads, so I guess you didn't build that company. And you know, businessmen even today,
I'll take it. That's a compliment. Okay, we're almost Fox Business.
businessmen, you know, even today are too often the worst defenders of their own success and their own prosperity. And you know, and the American businessman is too often not the best defender of American business or America writ large.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely. What was the second question you answered?
The second question was, what's the difference between cooperation and compulsion? And it makes the point that that a free market is based on voluntary interaction, and that is the basis of how you interact in a free society, and that, you know, the choices you make are made on your own selfish interest and for your own benefit, and that you're not compelled to, whether it's, I don't, you know, buy insurance for the greater good, or, you know, for your health insurance for the greater good, or buy American goods to help your neighbor or the American farmer, that a proper moral and just society is based on voluntary trade. And it all, and that's the basic promise and premise of life in America. So it sounds so basic to us now, Yaron, but, you know, again, it's like we're dealing and having to face all of these issues again and again and again in our modern politics, even with people supposedly on our side.
Yes, absolutely. And I think my chapter is, you know, the kind of bringing it today, right? And one of the issues I raise is all kind of the questions that are raised today that she wouldn't have even imagined at the time, whether it's, you know, whether it's Islamic totalitarianism or just the rise of religion globally as a powerful force, whether it's Islam in the world out there or Christianity in the U.S., the rise of nationalism. I think ideas that she would have found as horrific in terms of their potential to be successful in America. I mean, she would have just, and the response, for example, our response to 9/11, our response to the rise of religion in America, I think she would have been very disappointed that 70 years or 60 something years after the publication of Atlas Shrugged, these are the kind of battles we're fighting, or 70 something years, 80 something years after publication of Textbook. You know, these issues related to individualism and collectivism are still at the forefront, in spite of everything she has written, in spite of everything we have tried to do to fight them off.
I have to admit, Yaron, when I first read, in Leonard Peikoff has told the story, when I first read Atlas Shrugged, I experienced, I believe, probably not so dissimilar to what Dr. Peikoff mentioned. When I read it, it was such a revelation to me, Yaron. I said, oh, well, that's it, you know, if everyone just reads this, that's it. The world will change. And, you know, and it's just so difficult to get people to change their ideas, especially when all of the world is so focused on altruism, so focused on sacrifice. And that's why I think your section is tremendously important, especially what you talk about in terms of nationalism, Yaron. You know, Rand, obviously very much, you know, in the news these days. Yaron, because Rand talked about it, and you reprint her comments from the Q&A, but you also build on what nationalism looks like today and what Rand may or may not have thought about it.
I mean, it's tough to speculate on what Ayn Rand would have thought of these things, but we try. I mean, what could we do? She's not here to tell us. And I think her conception of nationalism is very different. It's Americanism. It's what's in the book. And it's far different than the conception of nationalism that is popular today, which is a collectivistic conception, an anti-American conception of nationalism. When Donald Trump says he's a nationalist, he is referring to an un-American form of nationalism, a collectivistic form of nationalism that goes against the principles of that the country was founded on, and against the principles that Ayn Rand is articulating in the book. So again, I think the book is an incredible contribution to a further understanding of Ayn Rand's political thinking and political thought and its application to the world in which we live today. Many of you out there, you know, legitimately think you've probably read everything Ayn Rand's written about politics. Well, there's a lot of new stuff here that hasn't been published before in terms of a new material on politics. So her seminars, you know, which are basically, this is a transcript of our discussion about politics, are just gems in terms of the material there, and it's never been published before. So
there's a part of one of the Donahue interviews where Donahue asked, I'm sure you know the moment, she asked Ayn Rand, you know, you love this country, don't you? And Ayn Rand says, I love it for its ideas.
Yep.
And it's such a great moment. And I'd like to think that these are the ideas.
Yep.
And these are the ideas of why anyone should love this country, wherever you come from and wherever you are. What makes this country so special, so unique, and such a tremendous opportunity, Yaron. I mean, people, even to this day, get in a dinghy raft and swim here through muck. They hide out underneath trains and, you know, they'll do anything.
Oh, no, no, but these are bad people, Jonathan. These are bad people coming here to destroy the country and to rape our women and pillage our villages and destroy everything we have. These people should drown. They should all drown. Ah!
They're coming here to pursue their American dream.
Yeah, exactly.
And their success, your own, is our success.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, let's do some questions. They're all over the place. And then we'll talk a little bit more about the book, and then I want to talk to you about the stock market because,
sure.
Hey, I need somebody to explain it to me. All right. All we ask, this is kind of a long question, so let's see if we can get. I believe that helping strangers is a necessary feature of a society to function. Living in a society in which people help strangers is beneficial to every individual within it. However, I believe that helping a stranger would be altruistic if not for the fact that doing so makes you feel good and it makes others venerate you. In addition, I believe that these internal and societal reactions come from evolution. What if there are behaviors that would be extremely beneficial for society, but for which the internal and social cues necessary to make them rationally selfish have not been evolved yet? Oh my God, there's so much there. You want to take a stab at this?
Well, I'll just quickly throw out that, you know, Don Watkins, terrific thinker and writer, his contribution.
My co-author. Yes.
Co-author. Yes, of course, you don't know very well.
Read books.
His contribution asks, he asks, can charity be a right? So he addresses this exact question of charity in America, charity in a free society. Is it important? Why is it important? And Don explains that quite specifically.
Yeah, so Ori, buy the book because you should read Don Watkins' answer about charity, and he gives a good explanation. And quickly, let me just say that, again, I think the whole framework by which you ask the question is the wrong framework to ask the question. I don't know what it means to benefit society. I don't know what the concept of benefit society means. What is society? Where is society? Who is society? Does it benefit everybody in society? Does it benefit them equally? Does the harm done to some people in society because of what you did outweigh the benefit that some people get from it? Oh, the whole discussion about benefiting society in the abstract, without context, is a very, very dangerous and wrong perspective. It's exactly what Ayn Rand talks about here in terms of it's a collectivistic approach to man's life, to living with other people. Whereas our approach is an individualistic approach. You cannot sacrifice your own life for anybody else. It's wrong for you to sacrifice your life, your values, to other people. If helping a stranger is a sacrifice, no matter who benefits from it, don't do it. Don't do it. Now, does it have to be a sacrifice to help other people? No, it doesn't have to be, but it can be. And if it is, if you are losing from the deal, don't do it. Don't get involved in losing transactions, whether it's helping strangers, helping friends, or helping anybody. If it's a loss to you, a loss, taking into account all your values, taking into account your hierarchy of values, what's most important, what's least important, taking into account your long-term, your life. If it's a loss, don't do it. That doesn't mean you shouldn't help a stranger. There are circumstances in which it's not a loss. There are circumstances in which it's a benevolent thing to do. It's money maybe that you don't have a particular need for. The stranger looks like there's somebody who, if they got their act together, could actually be productive and pay you back in some way through the fact that they are productive. Rational human beings care about other human beings. We care about human life. We care about plants, for God's sake. We care about animals. We certainly care about human beings. So helping somebody, helping another human being can be very beneficial, not because of how it makes you feel detached from why you feel it. You should feel good by helping a stranger if it's not a sacrifice. And if, and only if, you have a sense that at the very least, they deserve the benefit of the doubt. You don't know anything about them, and they're probably a good human being, and something good will come of it to you and to the people you care about. I'll just respond to this evolution. I don't buy these things come from evolution. Ideas don't come from evolution, and therefore emotions ultimately don't come from evolution. We're not programmed to help strangers. We're not programmed not to help strangers. You get to choose. That's why it's an issue. You get to choose whether to help strangers or not. So I don't buy the programming. I don't buy the whole evolutionary thing. I think the great achievement of evolution, achievement in a sense, right, of human evolution is free will, which basically makes it possible to override whatever programming there is, but it also makes it possible not to have programming. And I think that's the real leap forward that evolution made with human beings. It's the ability now not to have the programming so that you can program yourself based on evidence, based on facts, based on reality. Sorry, go ahead.
Would you agree too, in the political sense, you know, in America, but charity, voluntary charity produces tremendous benevolence. You do feel when you give to someone, whether it's the Institute or anyone else, when you give to someone or an organization where official or even you feel that sense of great pride that you're helping support a value. But when the government says, well, we got to help the farmers, we don't have the steel workers, you know, that just makes you hate everyone. That just makes you hate your neighbor. Resent your neighbor as against to really feel that benevolence toward.
I think that's right. But I also want to caution against the idea that the charity in and of itself is good, and that all of us should be charitable all the time, no matter what our circumstances are, and that feeling is always rational. Because I think a lot of people feel good because they give to charity because it reduces guilt that they should not have to begin with. I think some people feel good because they give to charity because they still have altruism and they still think that giving to charity is really, really important, even though it's not really part of their values. They've rationally explained it, but they still have those remnants of altruism, so they can't give it up. So I want to be clear that, yes, I think charity can be a rational value, but it has to be rational. It means you have to think about it. You have to figure it out. You have to understand why you're doing it. And then the feeling is justified, and it's a good feeling, and it's a just feeling. Suddenly, when the state does it, it's wrong. It's wrong because you don't get to choose who to help and who not to help. The whole point of it being a value is your ability to choose who not to help as well, and because it's cursed. So, and it's because you're told that it's the source of all values. It's the source of moral worth. It's charity. Charity is not important. It's fine. It can be nice. You can get a real good feeling about it, but it's not important. And of course, what you want to support through charity are your values, are the things that are important to you. Go ahead.
I actually don't think it's in the book, but I know, Ms. Rand has made the point that if you really care about poor people, you're going to want to leave the successful producers, the business people, as unencumbered as possible.
Absolutely.
In need are really right on their coattails. I don't know a better way to put it. They depend on the success of everyone else.
And if you care about poor people, you want to keep the poor people as free as possible, without licensing restrictions, without minimum wages, without all the regulations that keep poor people poor. I mean, we forget about that, you know, that we inhibit the ability of poor people to rise up. All right, let's see. Some of these I'm going to skip, and I'm going to try to get to them. I don't know what that means. More people love Iran because of Trump. I don't know what that means. Okay, good. I hope that's true because of my views on Trump, I assume. Should both of you do seminars for the wealth producers to teach them pride in their achievements like Alex Epstein is doing with oil and gas executives?
Invite us, for sure.
Yeah, we'd love to do it. But Alex, of course, has built a business. So don't just say, go build, you know, he wants us to build a business. We're busy. But yes, that would be a great venture to engage in. And it would be nice if wealth producers actually invited us to do it. It's not an easy business. Good for Alex to have figured out how to do it, you know.
But you know, also, you know, if I can quickly just say, like, I want to go around the country, and I'm going to be doing some speaking next year. I want to get people cheering for this country. You know, there's this cynicism about America now.
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah. America, you know, fat people or, you know, whatever. Just, you know, people write, like, America, you know, like, kind of like, this
yeah.
is denigration of America now.
Yeah.
That I want people should be thanking their lucky stars every day that they're here and cheering for what this country is about and what it still could be.
All right. So Sam is asking, will both of us be at OCON 2019? I want my copy of New Textbook of Americanism signed by all the authors. So the answer is yes.
Sure.
We'll all be at OCON 2019. Come to OCON 2019. Bring your book. You should buy it now, but you could also be able to buy additional copies at the conference, and yes, I think we'll have a long table, and all the authors will sit there and sign all the books, so you can get everybody's signature on the book, and one day that'll be worth a fortune. So, what's going on with the stock market?
Well, it's pretty weak. It's you know, I think the trend is down. I don't think the bottom is in just yet. We can talk about why, what causes this and that. But you know, I'm a trend follower,
yep.
when it comes to markets. I really believe that price is primary and price is what you should follow. So I, you know, I don't, and of course I'm not making any investment recommendations, but you know, I think it's probably more likely we're going to see 22,000 in the Dow more than we see 26,000 anytime soon.
And why do you think that is? So what's moving the markets down?
Well, I don't know, honestly. I don't know. I mean, it certainly could be that we're 9 years into a bull market and trees don't grow to the sky. And this is historically, you know, one of the longest bull markets in history. So that could be a factor.
You mean the stock market went up under Obama's presidency? Is that true?
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
It's so funny.
How's that possible? All right. Yeah.
Well,
so,
right. So I remember for many years, you know, as I said, I'm a trend follower. So for years, I would be mentioning on Fox, you know, hey, the market's at an all-time high. That's generally a bullish sign. And people say, oh, that's just funny money. That's just, oh, that's just the Fed. But then when Trump came into office, all of a sudden, oh, look what Trump has done.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So,
I mean,
so, okay, so part of it is just fatigue, I guess. I guess the market's been up for so long. Anything more fundamental that you're seeing in terms of why you think the market might be going down?
Well,
because you said price is primary and people are reevaluating prices. Why do you think they're reevaluating prices?
Well, I mean, the tariffs are bad. I mean, there's no this. You don't need my analysis of this, Yaron. I mean, Henry Hazlitt did this, Adam Smith did this. We know that, I mean, Ford and GM have both been out saying that tariffs are costing, you know, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars. So we know that some of what the president is doing and some of economic policy has been very, very bad. So I think that is having a factor of it. I'll tell you, you know, I don't want to get too in the weeds here, but I see a credit crisis brewing.
Which credit? Is it corporate credit, individual credit, sovereign credit?
Corporate in particular,
corporate.
Yeah. I mean, what I'm seeing, and I, you know, I haven't seen this, and again, maybe it's not exactly an Americanism, but I haven't seen, you know, banks and bank-related, and this is your world. Who am I talking to now? I mean, you tell me. I mean, you know, bank stocks, your own, have been getting killed in the last couple of weeks.
Oh, you're telling me.
Yeah. And
you're telling me.
And for bank preferred stocks.
Very depressing, yeah.
And I haven't seen that in 11 years.
No, the market is definitely signaling a credit you know, a reevaluation of credit. Banks are getting clobbered. I mean, they're not just going down. They're down more than 20% from the peaks. In June was actually the peak. Bank stocks peaked in the beginning of June. And they were weak through October, until the beginning of October, and then they've been just, you know, crushed. October, November, now December. And, you know, I think that I think there's a lot going on, but I think funny money did play into the rise in the stock market. And I think the funny money, it went into the credits and a lot of companies over leveraged because everything was so cheap. Debt was so cheap. And I think the market is finally starting to price the possibility of a credit crisis and the possibility of a recession sometime next year, where companies struggle to pay back their debts. You're already seeing emerging markets like Turkey, and you saw it in Turkey and you saw it in Argentina, really having a hard time paying back their dollar denominated debt. And I think people are worried that American corporations are going to be, it's going to be hard for them to pay back. They got a one-time boost from corporate tax cuts. But what is the good news that's going to generate, you know, further growth? It seems like most of the news is bad. As you said, trade is bad. You know, the whole political uncertainty, I think, is bad for the economic growth. Democrats in the House, even more spending than we have today. Maybe that's dragging. But yeah, I think the fundamentals are now shifting towards potential recession. And credit, I think, is the source. Yes.
Well, and I mean, for me, you know, your own, and again, I mean, people have to do their own due diligence. Part of what I love about investing is that it's kind of like America. Everyone has to find his own path, his own understanding, has to kind of make sense of it and come up with an approach that works for him or her in terms of their own situation. But what I've often found is that, and why I believe in price so much, is that the price moves before the news. So, you know, in the last year, we've been hearing, you know, ad infinitum about how good the economy is, how strong the GDP is, how low unemployment is. That's all true, but that all happened finally in year 9 or year 8. You know, in year 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 of the bull market, those headlines were all very bleak.
Yep.
So that's why I always feel like price moves first and the headlines come later. And that's why I mean,
something has to move the price, though. So there's something underlying that causes markets to shift, right? So the price is here and then the price is lower. And yes, then everybody rushes in to explain. I used to have these for my classes at school. I used to have these Wall Street Journal front pages of the Wall Street Journal investing section. And one said, interest rates went up, therefore stocks have come down. And the other said, interest rates went down, therefore stock prices went down. So they both gave opposite explanations for the exact same phenomena. So what everybody rushes in after the fact to try to explain why the price has moved, and I think that's what you're referring to. But there has to be a cause. The cause is not the price. The price is a product, right? Or do we disagree on this?
Well,
somebody is pricing stocks. Somebody is deciding it's worth 100. Somebody is trading as if a stock is worth 100, not 200, not 50.
I mean, I'll just put it this way. You mentioned, you know, bank stocks. I haven't seen, you know, banks really down, you know, 15, 20, 25, even more in many cases from the highs in a long time. And yet a lot of the earnings for that companies, a lot of the fundamentals are still quite good. So I'll just say this is that, you know, if I have I focus on what's happening with the price because that's what we trade. That's what we invest in.
Yep.
And what often happens, I find your own, you know, that practice of, you know, buy the rumor and sell the fact. So the stock will go up and up and up and up. And then good news comes out, the stock goes down because the news is out. So again, I don't want to get too in the weeds, but I'm scared about the economy. Count me as one of those who thinks that, you know, recession is one of those kind of, what does it mean really when you say we're in a recession? But
economic contraction where the economy just not, is shrinking, not growing. It's shrinking.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to see tough times in the stock market and a credit crisis in 2019, if not before.
All right, you heard it here. Hopefully everybody's, don't trade based on what we just said. Do your own due diligence, as Jonathan said, and make your own decisions. Marvin put $10 in this question, so I'm going to I'm going to ask it and see what you think, and then I'll give my answer. How are Gates Jobs model, you know, so how are these entrepreneurs model when they sell back doors into the, it says here cigarettes, but I assume he means servers or something like that, and they snitch for the government worldwide, like in China, and they give the NSA a back door into their servers. Why are they still model in spite of doing that? Thoughts. Yeah, you're going to be giving talks. You're going to have to answer Q&As. This is a good practice.
I mean, I use Google 1,000 times a day. It's never cost me anything. And I always tell the story, Yaron. And as a kid, my parents bought the Encyclopedia Britannica for us in 1984. I think it was $1,400 back in the 80s. And that was like $3,000 today for the Encyclopedia. So, you know, Google and these tech companies are big companies. There's a lot of arms and planks and elements of them. I can't condone everything necessarily they do, all their business practices. But, you know, writ large, these companies have created huge values that have benefited me tremendously. So how can they be anything other than heroes? And they did it, not by getting a subsidy or getting a Build America bond. They got it by private investors and entrepreneurial trade.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, yes, not everything these companies do I agree with. Not everything these companies do I like. And certainly some of the stuff they do with government is bad. But what choice do they have? You know, partially it's there's a gun. A government points a big gun at you, and you have to decide whether you want to stay in existence or not. And many of them compromise in ways that I wouldn't compromise, but as compared to their achievements, all the things Jonathan just talked about, I mean, wow, they're giants, you know, given what they have achieved and how much they've contributed to my life. All right, Liberal Deutsch asks about Niall Ferguson's six killer applications. I don't know if you know what the six killer apps are. So Liberal Deutsch, I'm going to look those up and I'll talk about them in another show, because Niall Ferguson is definitely an interesting guy, so it'll be worth looking them up. Let's see. Oh, got all these down here. Okay. Quickly. Are we entering a bull market through 2020? Jonathan.
Actually, I think he corrected himself and asked bear.
Yeah.
Bear. And I think we are. I mean, half of the S&P 500 is already in a quote bear market.
Well, bank stocks are in a bear market. They've technically gone into a bear market. I mean, I don't know. I don't do these long-term market trends. I have a hard enough time figuring out banks. But we're certainly, I certainly think there's a high probability that the market is going to be down in the next few months. Very volatile, as you've seen lately, although this volatility really is just returning us back to the good old days of volatility before the funny money entered the market in 2009. But in the old days, this is how stocks traded. If you go back to 2000, if you go back to the 90s and the 2000s, stock markets were much more volatile than they were in the last 10 years. But I do think we're going to head into a bear market here in the next few months. I don't know how 2019, 2020 will end. A lot of times what happens is that by the time the recession gets there, the market is already recovering. And that goes back to the news aspect. See, I believe that prices reflect information about the future, and they price the future. And sometimes when the news comes out, the news is not as good as what was priced, or the news is worse than what is priced. The market reacts to its expectations, not to the news itself, but expectations. So what the news today implies about the future. And it might be pricing a recession right now. And once the recession comes, the stock market might be going up. So I don't know when it turns around.
You just answered your own question of why price is primary.
Oh, no. Well,
because if you wait around.
No, the price isn't primary.
Better.
Your future expectations are primary. So it determines price is my beliefs about the future. So the aggregate beliefs of the participants in market, as reflected in their trading, as reflected in their confidence about the future, is what determines the price, what causes the price. So the price is a manifest of people's few expectations about the future. That's what I think. Jonathan doesn't agree, but that's okay. We'll hash this out.
That's what makes it fun.
Yes, that's definitely what makes it fun. So I'm a big discounted present value guy. So in a sense of the something, we think there's going to be a recession in the future. The question is, how does that affect prices today? And we sell if we think the price, if we think the market's overpriced. And that's selling, if enough of us believe it, that's selling, or if enough dollars believe it, that selling gets reflected in that belief gets reflected in the price. Because the price has to come from somewhere. All right. I'm new to Ayn Rand. I have two questions. How would voluntary taxes work? Would it produce preferential treatments? And how do we convince people selfishness is a virtue? I tried, but people just dismiss you as evil and shut you down. All right. So you want to take voluntary taxation?
I'll let you answer these your own. I'll follow up, but please, I'd like to hear your perspective.
Well, I don't think so. First, voluntary taxation. How would it work? You would write a check every year. The government would basically say, we need this amount of money next year in order to fund the government. This is the amount of money coming in through fees, because certain things that the government would do would be through fee services. This is the gap. We need people to write a check to fill the gap. And then people would write a check and mail it to the government. And my guess is the government would want a surplus to roll it over next year. So the next year, the checks you'd have to write would be smaller. Would it produce preferential treatment? That is, Bill Gates would write a $2 billion check, and then he would get all the attention. Well, what kind of attention, right? So if you think about it, the government has very little power in a free market over our lives. So it doesn't subsidize. It doesn't give any favors. It doesn't give any grants. So what kind of favor? Now, you could say when Bill Gates is, I don't know, if he kills somebody and now he's in court and he's given $2 billion to the government, the judicial system will be more favorably inclined towards him. Well, this is why separation of powers is important. And this is why a judiciary needs to be independent from the executive and from the treasury and from all these other things. And the judiciary should probably be funded by a different mechanism than the mechanism that is involved in kind of voluntary transactions and writing checks. But there's a lot of technicalities to be worked out so as to make it clear and to provide transparency that people are not getting preferential treatment. That is, that we are equal before the law, and that the executive branch and the legislative branch are actually practicing equality before the law. So I don't know that I think we've answered all the questions that can be asked about voluntary taxation and taxation or the raising of revenue in a free society.
Can I also jump in too? I mean, would you also say too that Ayn Rand doesn't, at least in this book, talk specifically about taxes? I know she has some ideas about voluntary taxation, but would you agree too that if someone understands the proper role of government, if they understand the real scope of government, how small, limited it is, how delimited it is, then funding it almost seems like not such a big deal because it's easily doable relative to the size of the economy that produces.
Yeah, and I think at the end of the day, if somebody like Bill Gates wrote a $2 billion check to the government, they would return most of the money because they don't need $2 billion from Bill Gates. That is, again, the government is so small, needs so little money that, think about a government that's 90% smaller than it is today or 80 to 90% smaller than it is today. It doesn't require much funding, and it doesn't need the very rich to write big checks. And you could even imagine a situation where you can't give more than a certain amount rather than the other way around, right? Today you're forced into it. No, we don't accept checks more than $100,000 because we don't need it. And because we don't want to be perceived as favoring certain people over other people. So you could even believe that there's a cap. All right. But that's ask that question again another time because we're running out of time here, and I'll try to get into it. But Ayn Rand has an essay on taxation in Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, and I think, again, reading textbook will enhance your understanding of political theory, the size of government, the role of government, more importantly, the role of government and why I don't think revenue is a big deal. I get the question every Q&A, and it's like, it's not an interesting question. And Ayn Rand writes that in her essay, In Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal. She says, we've got so much time before we get there. There's so many real issues to deal with. How we exactly structure the revenue when we get to the ideal society, it's not going to be hard. It's not going to be hard. All right, the second one is, how do we convince people selfishness is a virtue? I mean, the best way to do that, in my view, is to live it. To live it. To live an honestly true selfish life. And to be successful and to be happy and to exude that self-esteem and self-confidence that, like Jonathan does, right? I mean, Jonathan exudes this happiness and he enjoys life and he's having a good time and he's living. He's alive. He's really alive. And when somebody asked him, hey, Jonathan, where's this come from? And he says, because I place my, you know, the priority on my values and I'm selfish and I'm self-interested and I follow Ayn Rand's philosophy. People go, huh, wow. And it generates this. It generates this kind of energy and happiness and excitement about living. That's fun. That's good. So the best way to do it is through example. The thing that's not helpful is to be obnoxious about it. Right? I live for myself and I don't care about other people. That doesn't help. You want to focus on what it does for you. Why do you live for yourself? What does it do for you? What does it mean to have a hierarchy of values and live by a hierarchy of values? And what are those values and why is reason so important? And why is happiness the goal? If you focus not on how you relate to other people, not on the anti-other people, but on the pro-you and on the pro-values and on the pro-life and the pro-happiness and the pro-living, then I think it's easier to convince people. Do you want to add something?
So much of what she, you know, has talked about in the book, Your Own, is how the basis of America is voluntary cooperation and how, you know, in pursuing your self-interest, you can only do so by offering values, offering praise to other people. And it's always a series of win-win relationships, win on top of win. And, you know, that's how you ultimately pursue your happiness in the country. So pursue your selfishness. I mean, it's talked about in different places throughout the book, but you should want people, obviously, to pursue their happiness. It should make you happy to see others pursuing their happiness and for you doing the same. And obviously this country is the only place where that is protected as it is.
All right. Yes, absolutely. So, this flows into the whole idea of capitalism and trade a principle and creating win-win relationships with other people. All right. No more super chat questions. I hate to say no more money, right? I mean, man, but we've got to let Jonathan go. We're already close to an hour and a half. And all right. Google is the new global government. What do you think? What would Ayn Rand say? What would Ayn Rand say? Why isn't Google a global government?
Well, what is government? Well, what is government is, Google is a service that I can log on to that gives me information. You know, government is a gun. Government comes to your house and says, do this or else. You don't have to use Google. I don't know, people say, oh, well, come on now. You have to. No, you don't. No, you don't.
We didn't use Google 20 years ago. You were around 20 years ago. I was around 20 years ago. There was no Google. We lived. We survived. I mean, it wasn't as much fun as Google has made it. But you can choose not to use Google or your cell phone or any of these wonders of technology.
And you know, Yaron, I'm now at the point where I can say I'm old enough to remember when. But so much of the hysteria over big tech, I remember being around Walmart 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Walmart's taking over everything. Yeah. Walmart's going to ruin the country. They're going to do this to wages. They're going to ruin every small town. That was the big fear, that Walmart is going to take over everything. I mean, these cover stories and Time Magazine and news.
IBM. I'm even that old.
Sure. Yeah. Yes.
You know, Big Blue.
Fear.
Big Blue is going to take over everything.
We're the ones that make big business big. And thankfully, we do. I mean, I love these companies.
In the 1960s, the big thing was, if you go back to movies in the 60s and 70s, the fear, the kind of the doomsday scenario was, corporations are going to take over the world. Corporate governments, they're going to take us all over, and governments are going to be irrelevant. You know, they're going to merge with the corporations. And it hasn't happened, and all these fears are way overblown. Look, Jonathan's absolutely right. The essence of government is a gun. The essence of government is coercion. Google cannot coerce you. Google is not a gun. And again, Ayn Rand talks about what government really is, what's the nature of government in the book. And an individualist perspective looks at government and looks at Google, and Google gives me so much that I, through voluntary exchange, actually, it's not even exchange. I get it for free. I have to put up with some ads, right? And government is harassing me constantly. Government takes 55% of everything I own. Government tells me what I can and cannot do. Government tells me what professions I can and cannot get into. Government tells me how much I have to pay my employees. Government tells me every aspect of my life. Government dictates to me. And if I don't follow their dictates, just your observation as an individual, you will go to jail. You can turn Google off. You can tell Google to go to hell. Nothing will happen to you. Maybe your quality of life will go down. But nobody will impose force on you. Nobody will take a gun out and march you into a jail cell. So this is why Ayn Rand's politics is so revolutionary, so different, and why it's so important to read up on her political theory. Two last questions. Isn't it more likely that objectivist ideas will take over the Republican Party over the next 100 years than a third party ever being successful? No, I mean, even there are days where I even think it's more likely that objectivist ideas will take over the Democratic Party than the Republican Party. I don't think it'll take over either party. I do think ultimately a third party is going to be necessary. I think both parties are so corrupt, their bases are so entrenched in irrational ideas, that the ideas here are going to require a completely rethinking of politics, and that's going to require new political leadership that I think will have to manifest itself in a new political party.
Yeah, we need the people who are in college now, your own, who are going to read this in 5 and 6 years when they're the assistants to the congressmen, and then those congressmen become senators and go on to become presidents. That, you know, we're planting seeds for a decade from now, long before we get the politicians. We need to change some of the ideas. And so, you know, and you make this point again and again, you know, we get the politicians we deserve. The ideas have to change, I think, for the politicians or the political parties do.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's all about education, education, education. All right. Liberal Deutsch puts so much money in his questions that it just can't be ignored. If one applies objectivism, this is going to be a doozy of a question. If one applies objectivism to what white nationalists might call white man's history, the superiority of Western values cleanses the WN, white nationalists, of much of their colonial guilt. Is that why many white nationalists are so attracted by objectivism? Wow. I don't think white nationalists are attracted by objectivism. I really don't.
White nationalists? There's a whole essay in the book about why why racism is un-American. You know, Ayn Rand called racism, she said it was absolutely disgusting. It's a barnyard mentality. I'm a pretty hardcore objectivist. I don't know any white nationalists. I don't associate with them. And if white nationalists, you know, associate with objectivism, I think anyone should disavow them and tell them to get lost.
Absolutely. No, I think why is some people who are of that perverse inclination, why they find something interesting in Ayn Rand is, I think it's because she's pro-Western values, and they think they're pro-Western values. They have no clue what Western values are. And that's the thing about white nationalists, is they don't actually understand what Western values are, because they associate Western values, they associate Western civilization with collectivism, with the geographic area. And Ayn Rand does not at all. For Ayn Rand, civilization, Western global good, amazing, virtuous civilization, is an issue of ideas. It's an issue of Aristotle's ideas. It's an issue of the Enlightenment. It's an issue ultimately of her ideas. That's what civilization is about. It's not about geography. It's not about the color of the skin. It's not about colonial history or anything like that. It's about ideas. So I don't think, I just don't see the connection between the two. And I don't think white nationalists are attracted by objectivism, maybe for a moment, because they think she's somehow pro the West and they associate. But very soon they reject objectivism. They can't stay objectivists. And to the extent that there are people out there today who think they're objectivists and they advocate for kind of collectivist ideas, yeah, you know, they're confused. They've always, I know people who think that objectivism and Judaism are the same thing. I know people who think that collectivism and Christianity, that objectivism and Christianity are the same thing. I know people who think that objectivism and Buddhism are the same thing. And then you're going to find people who think that objectivism and nationalism are the same thing. And they're wrong. All of them are wrong. They're just wrong. There's just no relationship between the two things. Indeed, objectivism is the most, is the ideology most opposed to white nationalism of all the ideologies out there. There is no ideology more opposed to white nationalism or any kind of collectivistic rationalism than objectivism. Because, as Ayn Rand says in the opening of the book, right, the opening of the book is, what is the basic issue in the world today, right? She wrote this in 1947, I think, 46, May of 1946. Ayn Rand wrote, what is the basic issue in the world today? Now, I'm asking you, what is the basic issue in the world today? And this is her answer in 1946. The basic issue in the world today is between two principles, individualism and collectivism. Now, I think today Ayn Rand would change the question a little bit, because post Atlas Shrugged, I think she would, some of this would be written a little differently. And I mentioned that in my essay in the book, that I think she would have identified two more fundamental principles. She would have asked the question, what is the basic political issue in the world today? And she would have said individualism versus collectivism. Because if she would have asked the question, what is the basic issue? It would be reason versus mysticism, and egoism versus altruism, and only then individualism versus collectivism. So if you remember, she said she was a capitalist because she was an advocate of rational egoism. She was an advocate of rational egoism because she was an advocate of reason. So reason versus mysticism is the number one issue in the world today. That leads to the moral issue of egoism versus altruism, which leads to the political issue in the world today, collectivism versus individualism. But all the issues she addresses in the book, right, in terms of individualism versus collectivism, apply today. It's sad in that sense that we're not in better shape than we were in 1946.
And, you know, it's part of my hope, Yaron, is really to help establish Ayn Rand as the American voice, is the American philosopher. You know, no other American thinker speaks for the country at its best like Ayn Rand does to this day. So I there was this, always this perception of her, you know, Russian, smoking, kind of grouchy old lady. And that's not Ayn Rand at all. Ayn Rand is the hope and promise, the benevolence, the aspirational promise of this great country. And that's what's in the book, and that's what makes it so tremendous.
I mean, what Ayn Rand did is complete the American Revolution. What Ayn Rand did is complete the work of the Founding Fathers. And you get a sense of that in the book, because she gives voice to what they meant by the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. She gives voice to the idea of inalienable rights. She explains what that actually philosophically means, right? And, you know, so, Jonathan, congratulations. This is an amazing achievement. I know that herding objectivist intellectuals into writing essays and getting them all into a book is worse than herding cats. And I know why this took a long time. So I was a little facetious earlier. It took a long time because I'm talking now in the name of objectivist intellectuals, take forever to write our stuff, and we take forever to edit our stuff, and we take forever to get feedback back to Jonathan. So it was all our fault. But Jonathan did an amazing job sticking with us and pestering us and getting us to do what we promised to do. And I think it's a pretty amazing collection. You've got, of course, Ayn Rand, new stuff from Ayn Rand. That's pretty cool. New stuff in terms of what people haven't read before. Lennon Peikoff, Andrew Bernstein, Harry Binswanger, me, Uncle Gatte, Stuart, Hayashi. Thank you. Jonathan himself, Ilan Juno, Amy Peacock, Greg Salamieri, Richard Salzman, Brad Thompson, and Don Watkins. I mean, that's a pretty cool lineup. That's fantastic. So when it comes to political philosophy, you're not going to get a much better lineup than that in terms of essays. So I encourage people to buy the book and to read it. And, you know, I'm sure it raises a lot of questions. You know, you might not even agree with everything in it. And that's good. You know, but that's think about it. Ask us, ask the authors. Come to OCON. The authors will be there. Ask them. Ask them when they're on the show. You know, challenge us on what we wrote in here, because you might not agree with what we write here. Stuart is insulted that I couldn't pronounce his family name. Sorry, Stuart. I'm really terrible at these things.
Thanks to you, to all the contributors, to Stuart, to Jeff Britting, all the people who help. It's available at textbookofamericanism.com. And also to the Institute, to the people who support the Institute. All of them have made it possible. So I'm appreciate it so much, and appreciate your support especially.
Oh, absolutely. And everybody go out and buy the book. Buy 20 and give them as Christmas presents. And you know what to do with this show? You got to share it. Sharing is the only thing that counts on social media. Share. And then you've got to go to Patreon, and I hope that you will support the show, because it's a value to you. And continue, those of you who supported already, thank you, and continue supporting it. Thank you for all of you who've watched us on live, on Facebook, on YouTube, I think even on, what's the thing that, Periscope. I think we're even on Periscope. And those of you who are listening in on Blog Talk Radio, thank you all, and have a great, what day is it today? It's like Wednesday. Wow, the week has already passed. So have a great rest of the week. Have a great weekend, and I'll probably be back with the show on Saturday. I think tomorrow night and Friday night, I'm going out with friends for dinner, and I think we're going to take a little bit of a break, but I'll be back on Saturday with the show. The only reason John Redpath isn't in the book, people are asking, is John is retired. We would have loved to have had John Redpath in the book. So thanks, everybody, and thank you, Jonathan. Thank you for the book.
Well, thank you all.
Bye, everybody. Bye, Jonathan.